Hey, everybody. Welcome into the back room. I'm Andy Ostroy. We have a very interesting guest for you today. She is Barbara Rez, and she worked for Donald Trump as his executive vice president in the construction area for 18 years. She's got a lot to say. We're going to get to her soon. But first, thank you for tuning in. We appreciate you listening, and we'd love to hear your comments. So email us at backroomandy@gmail.com and or post on our social media, and we'll read some feedback next time. And if you like the podcast, please follow or subscribe and rate and review, and you'll be notified every time we post a new episode. So here's some feedback we received this week. On our conversation with filmmaker Tom Zimney, Leslie J. writes, "I was so pleased with myself that I canceled Netflix months ago. After listening to your Tom Zimney interview, I had to sign back up so I could watch Sly." On our conversation with Alan Zweibel, Alan Devins writes, "An absolutely charming hour. I'm not a podcast gal, but I did manage to download it somewhere to share with others. Thank you. Great interview." And on our conversation with the one and only Danny Bonaducci, Sarah Such wrote, "This was a wonderful podcast, and Danny is amazing." Lynn writes, "Awesome. Just so honest and real. All Danny. Really enjoyed it." Patricia writes, "Sorry about your childhood, Danny. Nobody should have to go through that by the hands of a parent." All right, let's get to our two big things.
I see a future for all Americans. I see a country for all Americans. I will always be president for all Americans because I believe in America. I believe in you, the American people. You're the reason we've never been more optimistic about our future than I am now. So let's build the future together. Let's remember who we are. We're the United States of America. And there is nothing beyond our capacity when we act together. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you.
That was the State of the Union last night. That was President Biden. That was our guy. Republicans, here's your guy.
In Venezuela, did you just see Maduro? Venezuela, it's unbelievable. We're getting rid of the Romneys of the world. We want to get Romneys and those out. But they know that we are the only ones who can stop them. We're the only ones. This is the greatest movement in the history of our country, maybe in the history of any country. Even Argentina, they went MAGA. You know Argentina, great guy. He's a big Trump guy. He loves Trump. I love him because he loves Trump. When he called, I took his call. Anybody that loves me, I like them. I said, "Abdul, he's still there. He's the head of the Taliban." He said, "You're killing us all. Just don't do it anymore because terror will rain down on you." And he called you, yes, Your Highness. He called me Your Highness, which is interesting. We are a nation that just recently heard that Saudi Arabia and Russia will be
Oh, my God. where do we begin?
Don't cry for me, Argentina.
That's Mr. Argentina to you. What the fuck is he talking about? Argentina, great guy. Great guy. He loves Trump. I love him. Who is he talking about? That's a fucking country.
He mixes things up a little. What can you do? I mean, you know, you got to give him a break. He's a busy guy.
Your Highness? Your Highness, he calls me. The Abdul guy from Taliban. Like, Trump is, like, texting with the leader of Taliban. "Hey, what's up, Abdul? Hey, Your Highness, what's up?" What is he talking about?
The quiet part out loud again. He wants to be Your Highness.
And then, like, Venezuela. Like, what was that? That's a new country. Venezuela.
There's nothing new here. I mean, Tim Apple was, while he was in the administration, he never gets anything straight. He's never sound cognitively.
So here's the thing. You watch that speech last night, which, walking into it, Biden, his team, and Democrats knew this needed to be the fucking speech of his life. And he fucking nailed it. He slammed it out of the park. He wildly exceeded my expectations and everyone that in Democratic circles expected as well. It was epic. And then you have this fucking clown, right? And we have a conversation about dementia. We have a conversation about mental acuity. We have a conversation about who is or isn't unfit. is that really a serious conversation? I mean, Biden spoke for over an hour with such command, with such strength and forcefulness, and Trump, he can't speak for 3 minutes without sounding insane. So I think what happened last night was that Joe Biden laid to rest on a serious level, and he's too old talk. Now, they'll still do it. That's not going to stop them. But for the people who matter, who watch that, moderate Republicans, independents, the people who voted for him last time, there's no question. There's no question. The man is fully in charge of his mental capabilities. He is fully in command of the facts, the details, and he demonstrated leadership.
I think he definitely alleviated all the fears of Democrats, which were getting palpable. You know, obviously, it doesn't make any difference to his base, and it probably helped with independents, but it remains to be seen because the swing states are all that really matters, and whether this works in Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia is all that matters.
Yeah, well, it's a math problem, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Joe Biden needs to keep the people on the right and in the middle who voted for him last time. And there's been nothing in terms of elections to date that would indicate that he has a problem. That's number one. But number two, there is nothing to indicate that the people who chose him over the maniac for that reason, not because they love Biden, they voted for Biden because they could not vote for a sociopath. The majority of those people, the overwhelming majority of those people, I just don't see them leaving Biden.
I think the fundamental problem is that for Biden, he has to win the popular vote by between 5 and 6 percentage points because of the Electoral College. And that is where we run into problems because, yes, I agree with you that those people aren't going to be voting for Trump. But when you look at the No Labels Party and you look at RFK Jr., you're going to see on those swing states, those people are on the ballot, and all it needs to do is break the coalition a little bit, and that's it.
Yeah, well, the question with those two examples, which are good examples, is who will they take votes away from? It may just end up being a wash. There's probably just as many Democrats who like Bobby as Republicans.
Bobby is a mixed bag, I agree, but if the No Labels Party gets someone like Cornel West on Georgia and Arizona and Michigan, that takes almost exclusively from Biden from every poll.
But I think the key here is that we have 8 months left. The economy is on fire. We saw last night Joe Biden addressing the immigration issue in a way that kind of pissed off some Democrats. He used the word illegal. So he's look, politics is a dirty game, and he's going to have to throw around some terms and rhetoric that is going to satisfy certain people. People who are concerned about the Israeli situation in Gaza and Palestinians. All these are complicated situations, but unfortunately, there's a dumbing down in this country of all the important issues, and sometimes you just have to speak in bumper sticker language that resonates. And so when he used the word illegal, while it pissed off Democrats, perhaps to the people who matter, they like hearing that. They like knowing that he understands that it's a problem. He did the same thing with Israel, calling for a ceasefire, calling for a two-state solution, talking about building infrastructure outside of Gaza to get a significant increase in humanitarian aid into the country. So between now and November, whether it's him constantly demonstrating that he is not too old, between the Israeli situation likely going to be remedied on some level, okay? Immigration, he took control of that last night. He bitch slapped them on that. He made them look foolish, like they are the ones that are raising the flag about the crisis, but willfully doing nothing about it because their master, Donald Trump, told them not to because it's for political reasons.
Well, you bring up a bunch of good points, and I think that anybody who is watching about his acuity, to your point, when he went off script, and his script was good, and when he went off script, he was even better.
Oh, totally.
And everybody was waiting to see how he was going to handle the Marjorie Taylor Greens, and he was, and that's how you know that he still has his shit together because he was strong. Mm-hmm. And we live in upstate New York. It's been raining and miserable. And today, the sun is shining. I feel like a different person. Yeah. Look, the weight has been lifted from my shoulders.
He also injected humor. Like, there was a point where he pointed out to Lindsey Graham. He goes, you know, I know I may not look it, but I've been around a while. Like, that was like his Ronald Reagan, I won't let my opponent's youth and inexperience be held against him. But he fired on all cylinders. All cylinders. There's not one thing as a Democrat that you could say, I watched it last night, and I wish he would have finished that sentence. What would you wish? He more energy? Stronger? Sure. More forceful? More in command? You wish he didn't stammer so much? There was no stammering.
He's also not new. So people know that he has a stuttering slash disfluent issue, and that's okay. That's not going to make or break him.
Mm-hmm. See, I think all middle class and working class people, voters, ever need to do is just watch the State of the Union and see what Republicans refuse to clap for.
Mm-hmm.
It is everything they need in their lives. For example, in terms of democracy, they refused to clap when the subject was Trump sucking up to Putin and letting him march through Europe. They refused to clap regarding America's comeback from the pandemic. They refuse to clap about lowering prescription drug prices. They refuse to clap about every child being able to read by third grade. They refuse to clap about cutting child poverty. They refuse to clap when Joe Biden talked about children shouldn't go hungry. They refuse to clap about humanitarian aid to Gaza. They sit there with their arms fucking folded, with stern faces, and refuse to acknowledge or applaud or support anything related to the working class and the middle class. So if you're sitting at home and you're watching and you're like, why the fuck would I vote for these guys? Biden is the one talking about raises for teachers, a $400 a month tax credit, cutting credit card late fees, talking about ways to ease the financial burden on the lower and middle and working classes in this country. So if any of them watch this State of the Union, how could they walk away going, nope, nope, Biden, Democrats, not for me. It's those other guys that won't fucking applaud or clap for anything that I need and care about. So I don't know. Hopefully that's going to be fodder for advertising for the next 9 months, because that says it all. There's new polling out recently that said that people are starting to feel the impact of the economy. It's all going to come together because it's real. It is real. It isn't fake. The people who matter, moderates, independents, people are like, damn, my stock market account's doing well. My job is great. I'm earning. I got a raise. Unemployment. Like, those people know what the economy is. Then they'll vote. It's still the economy, stupid.
It's all baked in. You know, 8 to 10% of people, like you're talking about, that everyone has to win, and they only have to prevent other people from voting for Biden and going somewhere else in three or four states. So everything comes down to three or four states. And all of what you said is true, but it doesn't matter. They're not going to get any of that information because it'll be filtered through OAN and Fox News and their own Facebook feed, and none of it matters. I do want to call out, though, that I thought that Biden's opening was incredibly strong, and that he opened with Ukraine was incredibly important, and I think we want to emphasize that.
Yeah, on Ukraine, he said, we will not walk away. We will not bow down. I will not bow down. History is watching us. And he got a little bit of a nod and a affirmational look from Mike Johnson behind him. Mike Johnson, by the way, literally, like, it's when you're driving in the middle of nowhere and you've like, oh my God, explosive diarrhea is coming. And where the fuck is a bathroom? Siri, where's a bathroom? And like, you have no cell service. Like, that was the look on his face nonstop.
He didn't know what to do.
I understood that look.
When he got to the J6 part, he finally just started shaking his head because he had nothing else to do.
Yeah, these people cannot even applaud for like attacking the J6 rioters.
Like the Patriots? Why would they?
Freedom fighters? What are you talking about?
Let's play that clip about Biden and the economy.
4 years ago, next week, before I came to office, the country was hit by the worst pandemic and the worst economic crisis in a century. Remember the fear, record losses. Remember the spikes in crime and the murder rate, raging virus. It took more than 1 million American lives of loved ones, millions left behind. A mental health crisis of isolation and loneliness. A president, my predecessor, failed the most basic presidential duty that he owes to American people, the duty to care. I think that's unforgivable. Inherited economy is on the brink. Now our economy is literally the envy of the world. 15 million new jobs in just 3 years, a record, a record. Unemployment at 50-year lows. A record 16 million Americans are starting small businesses, and each one is a literal act of hope. With historic job growth and small business growth for Black and Hispanics and Asian Americans, 800,000 new manufacturing jobs in America and counting.
So this is what I think people are going to remember. James Carville, is the economy stupid? It's always been the economy. It's always going to be the economy. People are going to look in their pocketbooks. They're going to look at everything, and they're going to go, all right, I'm going to hold my nose. I'm going to vote for Biden because I want this to continue. The other thing is Katie Britt, the rebuttal. Fucking crazy. Crazy. This is who they chose?
I think she was a great choice.
She makes Sarah Palin look smart and real.
Disagree.
What a dinner theater performance that was, and a bad one.
There were better performers in high school.
God, and the staging? I mean, it's not like it's Women's History Month or anything like that. To have a woman in the kitchen? Seriously? That's where you stage her?
They're not. She's not for you guys.
Hey, Republican men, where do you want your women? There. In the kitchen.
Yep. Yes.
It's Women's History Month. It's insane.
She's also young and pretty, and she was doing that fake sucking up to men crying bit. It's very effective for a lot of people.
You know, I'm going to say something that might not be popular on the right, but it's true. These Republican men, they want women who are fuckable. If you look at their women, you know, Kristi Noem, Nancy Mace, this one, Boebert, you know, some find her attractive, but like that's who they see someone they want to sleep with. They don't care how dumb she is or how incompetent or unqualified she is or how embarrassing she is. You think she was up there because she was the most qualified in the caucus to answer the president of the United States?
It doesn't matter.
I think that I think that anyone who wants a political future in the Republican Party should never do these rebuttals because the history of their rebuttals has never gone well. Marco Rubio with the water glasses.
Sure. What's his name? Bobby Jindal?
Yeah. I mean, it's always been a fail.
Well done, Republicans. I thought it was great.
Yeah. As Republican casting goes, they nailed it.
Yep.
Oh, my God. All right. Let's talk about our next big thing for a minute. Trump. So this...
It's been a long week.
So this week, the Supreme Court gave Donald Trump a win with the 14th Amendment Colorado case. And of course, it's a great court. It's a great court. Absolutely great court. Totally fair. We'll see if he says that when they rule against him on immunity. Then it'll be a rigged court. Unfair. Deep state. Judges in Biden's pocket, even though he appointed three of them. Funny how so far we haven't heard about rigged elections. Isn't it amazing when Donald Trump wins elections, wins nominations, there's never talk of anything being rigged?
That's how a dictator rules.
It's like Joe Biden said last night, it can only be good when you win, mm-hmm. right? He pointed that out. Haley got out. McConnell. Let's play something from McConnell.
January 6th was a disgrace. American citizens attacked their own government. They used terrorism to try to stop a specific piece of domestic business they did not like. Fellow Americans beat and bloodied our own police. They stormed the Senate floor. They tried to hunt down the Speaker of the House. They built a gallows and chanted about murdering the Vice President. They did this because they'd been fed wild falsehoods by the most powerful man on earth. Because he was angry, he lost an election. Former President Trump's actions preceded the riot were a disgraceful, disgraceful dereliction of duty.
And that is precisely why I am going to endorse him for President of the United States.
Mitch McConnell endorsing Donald Trump. After that speech he gave after January 6th, now he's endorsing him. John Thune, others, just lining up.
He's the worst. He really is the worst.
They're all the worst, though.
No, he really is the worst.
He is evil.
I may shock, but others shock just as much.
They have no moral center. It's just, they're an evil party. They're an evil party. They're all lining up for him. They're all going to do it. Haley's going to do it. Mm-hmm. It's coming. They're all going to do it. You said it.
I did, actually.
I know you said it. Trust me, Maddie. I listen to what you say. Sometimes you're right. No, you said it a long
I was just, what can I say?
Sometimes, you know, you said it. You said they're all going to end up, if he gets that nomination, they're all going to line up behind him. And you were right then, and you're right, and if you say it again, you're right again. And that's what they're doing.
I just predict that they're as awful as possible, and then I'm right.
Yeah, well, look, I don't think in anything regarding politics it's a waste to try to be optimistic or positive, but oftentimes you're right. Oftentimes there's, especially when you're talking about Republicans, the GOP, it just ends up being the worst behavior possible.
Think of the lowest common denominator and bet on that.
Sure. Donald Trump also this week went begging to the court, please, please take less money. Please take less money. Why? Because I am fucking broke. I have no money. I have no money. All this shit that I've been force feeding my base for years about what a billionaire, I'm so wealthy, I'm so rich, I've got $400 million in cash, I got this, I got that. Nobody's as rich as me. He can't pay a fucking fine now. The likely scenario is he's going to default and they're going to seize his properties. This is all law. He has to pay. If he doesn't pay, they start selling his properties.
Totally agree.
That's what I think is going to happen.
I think he's going to somehow find a way to get the money.
Yeah. We'll see. All right. Winners and losers.
Andy, Matt, do you know why I'm wearing green today?
Why are you wearing green today, Jen?
I'm so glad you asked. Because my winner, Joe Biden, brought the Irish fire to the State of the Union address. I just wanted to thank Pat Ryan for that great quote, our congressman. Mm-hmm. My losers, a tie between Marjorie Taylor Greene and Rashida Tlaib for behavior beyond unbecoming during the State of the Union address. Mm-hmm.
My winner, of course, is going to be Biden for delivering everything. He delivered all he needed to deliver in a great State of the Union. My loser, I think Katie Britt's response to the State of the Union was horrendous. Her breathiness, her weird kitchen, everything about it I thought was a fail, and I don't think she'll be his running mate because of it.
My winner, Joe Biden. That's it. No explanation. My loser, I'm Mitch McConnell for having the spine of a garter snake. All right, let's get to our weekly rant. It's actually a letter to Republicans. Dear Republicans, I know you like to harp on the Joe Biden is too old thing. I get it, because you have to. Because you have nothing else to harp on. Because Joe Biden is perhaps the most productive, successful first-term president in history. Because our economy is booming. Because the world respects us again. Because he's demonstrated incredible leadership geopolitically. Yeah, that's our guy, a real winner. And because your guy is a fucking sociopath, a rapist, a fraud, a traitor, a criminal who's been indicted 4 times on 91 felony counts, who's a pathological liar, who's stupid. Oh yeah, he's dumb as fuck, a pathetic numbskull who can't get through a 5-minute speech without sounding like he's ready for a mental institution, who's completely, utterly, unequivocally incompetent and unfit to serve, a total loser, a fake broke-ass billionaire who's now in a court in New York begging a judge to take significantly less money than the $450 million penalty imposed on him because he doesn't have any money. Yeah, that's your guy. So yeah, right, Joe Biden, too old because he got nothing else. Well, guess what? Our guy stood for over an hour last night giving an incredibly passionate, strong, forceful, detailed, patriotic State of the Union speech. An energetic, inspiring speech about how he'll continue to help the American people, who says, I believe in America. Not like your guy who says, America sucks. No, your guy paints a dark, dystopian future for America, who does nothing but talk about himself and his grievances, who promises revenge, who vows to be a dictator, who's got nothing but anger, incivility, violence, and rapidly diminishing mental acuity. Yep, that's your guy. So, Joe Biden's too old? Well, he put that shit to bed last night. But sure, keep attacking him on his age, because he got nothing else, and everybody knows it. All right, let's get to our guest today. She is Barbara Rez. She's an attorney, author, engineer, and 40-plus year veteran of the construction and real estate development industries. Barbara was an executive vice president in charge of construction at the Trump Organization and has spoken out publicly against her former boss, Donald Trump, particularly about his treatment of women. In October 2020, Rez released her memoir, Tower of Lies, What My 18 Years of Working with Donald Trump Reveals About Him. Barbara, welcome into the back room.
Thank you.
So I'm very excited to talk with you today because at 18 years working for Trump probably puts you as the person who's worked and knows Trump the best of all the people out there who talk about him, correct?
Well, in terms of writing books and stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, you go back a long time with him. So I'm really interested to have you share some insights. But I want to start off with the fact that you, in 2007, went and got a law degree.
Yes.
After working a long time in the construction and real estate business.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you how that came about real quickly. I always wanted to be a lawyer. But when I was a kid, when I went to college and I studied engineering, my boyfriend at the time went to law school. It was not economically feasible for me in any possible way. So it just went on and worked and got just construction, did my thing. I have two kids. Mm-hmm. And at the time that they were looking at colleges, I said, I always wanted to go to law school. So my daughter comes home after a Christmas present. She handed me an LSAT review book, and I ended up in law school.
Wow, good for you. And so you are working with the American Arbitration Association. You also have Rez Solutions, which provides legal support to companies involved in construction disputes and litigation. So you're still like in your lane with construction and real estate, but you're also working on the legal side of things now, which is really kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And is it fulfilling the fantasy?
Well, no, because, you know, the fantasy was, you know, I didn't even know what it was, defending people and things like that. But most people, you go to law school and then you go and you specialize in something. I mean, wherever the job is, and, you know, right. And the same thing over and over. And it's not, unless it's litigation, it's not particularly, you know, exciting, but I do sort of everything. When I graduated from law school, I thought, oh my God, I've got 20 plus years experience in construction and real estate development, and I know construction, and I know I've been an arbitrator for all this time. They're gonna be knocking down the doors. I was so wrong. They don't want me. They don't want people with knowledge and experience. They want kids that they can pay
those damn
$50 kids. Yeah. $300. I mean, it was just not. And so I set up this Rez Solutions company a few years later to offer support to people that really didn't understand anything about construction, which is 99% of all construction lawyers. Mm. And they're paralegals and baby associates vet documents. They don't know what they're looking at. And they give them keywords. It's ridiculous. So I said, let me do this. I will help you. I will vet the documents. I'll do it faster than your people. I will help you prepare experts because I've on many arbitrations. I know what arbitrators expect. I know, you know, how to prepare a witness. They don't want. Nobody knows more than construction lawyers. They don't need the help. It's sad, really. It's a wonderful company, but I can't get to the people that could tell their lawyers, yeah, well, put her on board. The lawyers say, oh, we don't need any help. That's the end of it, man.
Well, hopefully after this podcast episode, they will be knocking down the doors.
That would be wonderful. But to answer your question, which I didn't get to, I think it's fun for me. The law is fun for me because I work for some people. I've done employment cases. I've done contracting, but nothing major. Wills. But for me, I mean, I'm always showing somebody. I threw that and I threw that.
Well, you worked for Trump for 18 years. Of course, you're always suing someone.
Right. Well, absolutely. I understand the mindset. But no, people get screwed over constantly.
Yeah.
And you can't afford a lawyer. Even malpractice, which is something I'm dealing with now. You get hurt, let's say, or you know, damaged. But it's a $50,000 case. No lawyer's going to go near that.
Right. Right.
Because, you know, an expert's going to cost you 10 depositions, all this. You've got to make at least a certain amount of money to recoup your money, and there's always a chance. It's hard to fight that. That's another thing. People think, oh, this poor doctor, insurance companies, they'll spend $1 million not to give you $10,000.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, good for you for at least reinvention. I'm a big believer in that. And I'm also a big believer in if you have something that you've had some ambition for, even if you do it at a later stage in life, before you meet your maker, you know, you can get to live out your dream a little bit. Not a lot of people get to do that. So kudos to you for doing that.
Well, you know, that's I mentioned that in my singing. That's something
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about that, because before we started and got on the air, you had told me you were a singer. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, when I was the kid, I mean, I was singing before I was talking, according to my mother. And, you know, I was always singing at parties and stuff like that. And, you know, when I got into high school, you know, there were people that played instruments. I always wished I played an instrument, but I never did. And I would sing, and then we had some shows. I was singing at shows, and, you know, it was really fun for me. But I think I'm good. I loved it. And, you know, I went to college, and that was basically the end of it. I mean, when I was 15 or 16, I was singing at a wedding. And a member of the band had a connection with a producer and liked my voice. So he said, come on, I want you to audition for this person. And the person was somebody that was like, you know, not a big star, but very involved in music. She was a singer herself. And they liked me, but my mother and my uncle, it was his party. They didn't want me getting involved, go to college. And that was the end of it. So 50 years later, I reconnected with this man that I sang with when I was playing, singing in high school. So we started, you know, working together, and we do what we call it from high school to old school, and play, you know, anything Sinatra was saying, anything Tony Bennett was saying, anything. Cole Porter ever wrote, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then a little sprinkles of 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. And we want to perform. But again, it's hard to find gigs.
Well, not to put you on the spot, but if you want to sing a chorus of something here and perform, you're more than welcome to give us what you got.
Oh, I just can't think of
a cappella.
Okay, I'll do it right now. But it's not my best song, but it's the first thing I got. All of me. Why not take all of me? Can't you see I'm no good without you?
You're pretty damn good, I gotta say.
Thank you.
Good for you. Wow, look at that. That should be your next reinvention. Yeah. Well, my motto is you only live once. I didn't make that up, but I do believe in it. You only live once. So I want to ask you, it's 2024. Donald Trump, he lost in 2020. He then was impeached twice. He then incited a deadly insurrection. He has made the most outlandishly sexist, racist, homophobic comments in political history. He has been indicted 4 times in 4 jurisdictions on 91 felony counts. A judge called him a fraud. Another judge called him a rapist. Yet he just became the nominee for the Republican Party for president of the United States. Can you, as someone who walked in his shadow for 18 years, can you believe where we are today?
Now, you know, when he started talking about running in 2015, I thought it was ridiculous. You know, I thought it was a stunt. And I think at the time it may have been. I remember Huffington Post said they're not even going to cover him. It's an insult to people that read our news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had said this many times when I was working for, oh, I'm going to run for president. Yeah. Because people would say, he should be governor. And, oh, no, I'm a president. Yeah. And in a way, I think he sort of took himself seriously that maybe he could. But We all thought it was preposterous. I mean, you know, he knew nothing. I can tell you that a kid with a sixth grade civics education knows more than he does about, even now, about government. But so when he actually was running, I could not believe it. I couldn't believe in this world that there could be such an unqualified candidate running for president of the United States, and then he was elected.
Were you absolutely gobsmacked when he was elected? Like, was that just the most astonishing thing to you, knowing him so well? I mean, the rest of us could have been completely shocked because we knew him from TV and he was just a New York bozo. But having been so close to him for all those years and knowing him in such personal, deep, intimate ways the way you did, it must have been unbelievable to you that he was now going to be our 45th president.
Yeah, I have to tell you that, John. I was visiting my daughter up at Swiss College, which went to school, and we went out to eat, she and my ex-husband and I, and had a good time, and we got in the car, and the radio was on, turned on the radio, and that was the announcement that Trump had been named, or looked, not that he had been named, but he was in the lead, and I said, my heart fell, right? Mm. I was devastated.
You and Melania.
That's another story. I was
devastated. We'll get to that in a second. Go ahead.
I couldn't believe it. And how could this happen? You know, and more and more goes on and on, and it stops.
Mm. As someone who worked with him so closely and who also has a law degree, do you feel that this is the year where the law finally catches up to him? We're seeing it already, and he's got so much headwind facing him legally. It looks like by the end of April, he'll probably be a convicted felon. Who knows by the end of 24? Is this the year, despite all his bombast and bloviating, that finally he's held accountable?
You know, I've said it so many times. You know, it's hard to believe it'll ever happen. I mean, I know that there's something going on with the Supreme Court now where they're not going to let them disqualify him.
Right.
I think he's convicted. You know, he owns so many people, and he's got the goods on so many people, and he pays off so many people. I just, you know, even Weisselberg, who was found guilty of perjury, whatever. I mean, I knew Allen pretty well. I never thought he'd perjure himself, you know. Mm-hmm.
That was going to be one of my questions to you. Why do you think he never flipped on Trump personally?
A couple of reasons. Number one, Trump takes care of him financially, okay?
Mm-hmm.
His kids were Trump was all over his kids, and vice versa. I don't think he would want to risk anything happening to his kids, to be honest with you.
Weisselberg didn't want anything to happen.
That goes to Cal Mary, too. I mean, Cal Mary, you know, it's where all the bodies are buried, he could write a book, and that would be...
Are you being figurative or literal?
I don't know.
Are we going to break some news here?
I
Give
know
me names.
Figuratively, I'm speaking figuratively, but I'm not saying that it's not possible, believe me.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question, because this has been bothering the fuck out of me for so long. Jeffrey Epstein, in your opinion... I mean, I don't think for a nanosecond that guy killed himself.
Oh, no, neither do I, yeah.
Do you think it's feasible that Trump and others, perhaps, somehow were involved in that? I mean, when you think about, this man was on suicide watch, apparently, but, like, everybody was asleep, everybody was gone, there was nobody, like, everything in the, if you made a list of all the unfathomable things that could have happened in a prison to allow someone to, quote-unquote, kill themselves, every one of them happened. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, you know, I can't say names because, you know, I don't want to slander anyone. Certainly something happened.
Mm-hmm.
Some reason, and there's got to be someone behind it that he ended up dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just makes perfect logic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what Trump's involvement is with him. It looked pretty ugly. When you see the pictures and you're glad handing it, or big smiles and everything, and you think about what Epstein did, it's pretty horrifying. But I don't know. I have no knowledge.
Yeah, I don't want to judge you, Barbara, but are you suggesting that the man who argued in court that he should be able to use SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his opponents might have had something to do with Jeffrey Epstein's death?
I can't say that. It's just
Trump. No way. He would only kill political opponents.
Well, you know, that's true.
I'm teasing, of course.
When you think about it, I mean, the one conspiracy theory I have going that involves Trump, and it is purely speculation, is what's going on with Alec Baldwin.
What do you mean?
He's being charged with murder and stuff. He didn't do anything. He picked up a gun, he thought it was safe, and he shot someone.
Uh-huh. But how does that connect to Trump?
Well, because for many, many, many years, Alec Baldwin totally ridiculed him.
Interesting.
Yeah, so
are you suggesting, Barbara, that the man who sat and watched Obama ridicule him was the motivation for him running for president so he can get even? Are you saying that guy may not have liked Alec Baldwin's impression of him and then worked his contacts to maybe get Alec Baldwin in trouble? That doesn't sound possible to me.
No, it doesn't.
Not Donald Trump. He is not at all revengeful. He's not a vindictive man.
I have absolutely nothing to believe that. I have no evidence. I have nothing. I'm not saying it, but it's just something, you know, that comes up. People talk about Baldwin.
Yeah, no. And you know what's interesting? This is a guy who literally, in 2015, floated the idea that he could kill someone and that he would not lose support. And what he's now basically saying is, I could kill somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose support, but also not be arrested or prosecuted for it.
That's why we have to answer the question you asked way back. I don't know. I mean, we always thought, and it didn't do anything really illegal, was just lying so much when we were working with him, that he made a deal with the devil, which really did. Never was right. He still believed that. But he just nothing stuck to him.
I have to push back on that because I don't think he can make a deal with the devil, because that would mean he'd be making a deal with himself.
Well, maybe there's more than
maybe
one
the
devil.
Devil's dad, like Darth Vader or something. Maybe there's like a Darth Vader involved.
Yeah.
So speaking of him owning people and paying people off or having the goods, when you see people in politics like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell or Ted Cruz or Tim Scott, when you watch the fealty, the pathetic, cowardly fealty, do you sit there and go, he's got something on them? Because that's the only explanation I could see.
100%. And, you know, and my theory, and again, it's a theory and it's only an opinion, I have absolutely no proof of any of this, but there are ways that Trump gets his loyalty. Because I saw it being done when I was working for him, but they weren't like, you know, illegal kind of ways, but you know, promising jobs. People want to be near him. People want to be part of his life. So he's done that. Finding out information about people, you know, what cow or mm-hmm. rap or stuff with or whatever, and then of course paying people money.
Yeah,
and those are the ways that I think that he could get, all of his patronage. Then there's the other part, which people with coattail kind of things, like Marjorie Taylor, whatever her last name is. I hate her so much again. She, you know, oh, Trump was this, Trump was that, because she's hoping to get into that, you know, that base that he has. Sure. And that number thing, yeah, people will do that.
Well, she's a great example. You take someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who just a couple of years ago would be lucky if she'd get a job at Hooters as a waitress, is now within at least, you know, 30, 40, 50% of the country, like a legit candidate for vice president. So, yeah, to your point, why wouldn't she suck up like that? But, you know, Donald Trump, with his deep pockets, he could hire the best PIs in the world. If he wanted to have Lindsey Graham, for example, in his pocket, right, he hires the best private investigators and he gets the dirt. He gets photos, he gets videos, he gets audio, he gets whatever he wants.
Could be.
Just like I think, you know, everybody thinks Putin has the same thing on him. You know, the infamous PP tapes.
You know, going back to 2015, they love to say, oh, because the minute that Obama insulted him and decided to run for president, I always thought and still do that he he never expected to win that election. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that it had something to do with Putin and Russia, and Russia and stuff like that. Once he found out what he could do, the power he had, and using the kinds of controls that I mentioned before, he learned he could do anything he wanted. He loved it.
So in 2020, you wrote a book called Tower of Lies, What My 18 Years of Working with Donald Trump Reveals About Him. What made you decide at that point in your life to write that book?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I got a call from a publisher. And he asked me if I was interested. I said, what do you give me up front?
Right. How much?
Whatever it was enough money for me to try, And I wrote a very good book. And he loved it so much. He was absolutely certain we have a bestseller that he brought in a writer. And that infuriated me. But the guy was wonderful, wonderful. And I wrote the book. There's no question in my mind. He would put things down and ideas, and I would, convert them to my words, because I couldn't have any possibility of someone talking for me. And interestingly, we recorded the audio, and I recorded it myself. And when she heard it, the publisher, he decided that it wasn't good enough for this multi-million bestseller that he thought he had. So he brought in someone, a very good professional, to read the book. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't stop him because I didn't have that power in my contract. I'm so angry and disappointed at that. Because imagine somebody, I don't read him, my saying, and I went into Trump and I said, I'm not taking this shit from you anymore. And she said, and I went into Trump and I said, I'm not taking this shit from you. What the hell is that?
Right.
That's not my story. That's not my voice.
Look, you bravely put the story out there. And I think a lot of people appreciated that, because the more other people can learn about him and understand him, perhaps the less they might be inclined to support him and vote for him.
Let me just say one thing about that, about the book. Once I knew that it was going to be published, because I thought it was a lock, I had tried to find publishers. I wrote another book before that. And, they weren't interested in me. I didn't win applause. So, and I wasn't a celebrity. And I thought, okay, in 2016, I approached the Clinton campaign. So I had a friend who was very big in it. And I met with someone high up in the campaign. We talked about the racist stuff because, I had really racist stuff. And they decided not to pursue it. This is my chance. This is my chance. Stupid publishing, terrified that Trump will sue. He's going to sue me. Please sue me. Please sue me. People buy my book. But it was an opportunity for me to present it on all facets. It wasn't going after, it wasn't a hatchet. I presented what he was like when I started working for him. He bought me a mint coat because someone was selling it. And he said, do you want that? And he said, okay, I'll buy it. It changed. And the importance of my book is that it actually shows what happened between Trump being the kid of a book on developer and Trump being this big shot celebrity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say in the book that it's not hard to look at the trajectory of his entire life and spot an unmistakable pattern. The bigger he got as a name, the smaller he got as a person. That's pretty profound, by the way. And true, Let's talk about his racism for a second. You also say in the book that, quote, his bigotry and bias control Donald's view of the world. You gave some examples, like when he saw you with a black construction worker, he said to you, quote, get him off there right now and don't ever let that happen again. I don't want people to think that Trump Tower is being built by black people. He got angry when you brought a young black job applicant into the lobby of another building. And he said, quote, Barbara, I don't want black kids sitting in the lobby where people come to buy million-dollar apartments.
That's true.
He hired a German residential manager, believing that his heritage made him, quote, especially clean and orderly. And then he joked in front of Jewish executives that, quote, this guy still reminisces about the ovens. So you guys better watch out for him. Okay, so yeah, Holocaust jokes are always very funny. We see what he's done recently, with the black people love my mugshot. They love me because I'm a criminal. I can't see anybody, but I can see the black.
I can't believe it.
But this goes back to the 80s when he took out that full page ad about the Central Park Five. And now knowing that they've all been exonerated, he still has yet to apologize for any of that. So he was, in your opinion, working for him all those years. He's a pretty blatant, shameless racist, is he not?
You know, I got to tell you about, because people criticize, how could you work for me? You don't know any better. You didn't live, you weren't a woman in construction at that period in time. You didn't know what construction, I mean, everybody, there was racism in the industry, clearly. Starting out, there were no black workers. By the time I was really involved, we had some more, and there were, you know, people picking job sites and stuff. So, you know, that changed. And, you know, so how could you work for him? Well, I could work for anyone they were, but none of his racist bullshit had an effect on my job.
Mm-hmm.
None. And I toned him down on many, many things. I was influential. There were other people. It wasn't just me. He respected people back then. He took advice. It was hard, and it was torturous a lot of times, but he listened to people. Mm.
Did you ever hear him use the N-word?
I don't think so, but I can't say. I mean, it's possible, but I can't say really. But don't remember, the N-word was not the N-word back then. It was a bad word. Everyone knew not to use it, but it wasn't something that you could ban a historic book for, like Huckleberry or whatever it was. That wasn't the N-word, you know? Mm-hmm.
I just finished watching Deadwood. I'm about 20 years late to the game with that. It's an HBO show that literally is about 20 years old, but it is one of the best TV series I've ever watched, and the N-word is all over that place. And it's kind of stunning in a way when you watch TV shows from just 10, 15, 20 years ago, movies, and when you hear that word, it's like, oh my God. But to a certain degree, you're right.
But, you know, the thing is, if it had been, I mean, you know, I noticed it. I didn't like it. I heard it all the time. I heard it every day on the job. Now, that would not happen. People don't use that word, and I'm glad. It's a horrible word, and it's demeaning. Mm-hmm. It's demeaning. I know what demeaning words are, being a woman in construction, but so I can't remember if he said it. Probably he did.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of made some history back in the day as being, like, I think, the first woman to really oversee a major construction job, and then working for Trump. I mean, with all the talk about his sexism, there is a side of him, I guess, that, you know, didn't see gender on some level when it came to putting a woman in a very high level important job, which is kind of an odd contradiction for him. How do you explain that kind of personality contradiction?
Well, you know, let me say this. I wrote an article for Huffington Post. So the women that built Trump Tower, the woman that built Trump Tower, I think, Louise Sunshine, you may know the name. She was a formidable, a social person with connections all over the world, especially politically, and helped him do the deal on the Grand Hyatt. And she was in charge of apartment sales. That was her job. And she brought in people like the head of, forget the company, big company, Steve Roth, I think his name was. And he brought in all sorts of people at the head of this market, the head of that department, entertainers. And so all these people bought apartments, and it was all through our connection. And I was afraid of her. She was impressive. And then there was a woman who ran the retail sales, not sales, rentals for the retail. We got rents there that were unheard of anywhere in the country or the world. And she was in charge of that. And then we had an advertising agency, which was owned by a woman. And I think Norma Foerster, his secretary, and me. These are the five women in his line. Why? Because he knew that he was better than them and they would never threaten him. And he knew that they would work harder than any man because they had to prove themselves over and over again. And he knew, for the most part, it got them cheaper.
So that's so interesting, because what you're basically saying is that his interest and support of women in the workplace, it's just layered with sexism at its root.
Yes. Hey, he said to me, and I don't know, this probably didn't get into the second book because it had really nothing. People don't know, need to know about Trump this way, but it's in my first book. When he hired me, he said, you know, men are better than women. But a woman, this is an exact quote, a good woman is better than 10 good men. And they believed that. And he wanted the most forceful. I mean, there was no wimps that worked for women. We were strong women, and we didn't take shit from anybody, especially me, in construction. And he loved that because he knew I would always be inferior to him. And when, I'll tell you when this really clicked with me, it was so funny. When he sat with Nancy Pelosi, and she was not going to let him make his State of the Union. And I said, this is the first time he ever had a woman that could trust him.
Oh, she's his nemesis. I mean, to this day, the image of her walking out of the White House with that coat and the sunglasses, like that fuck you Trump moment, it was beautiful. It was beautiful because we needed that. And here we were. You know, it's hard for me to hear all this ageism talk about Biden because it should not be about someone's age. It should be about how fit they are and capable they are. And we saw in those moments, whether it was the hand clapping moment at his address or the coming out of the White House after schooling him in the meeting they had, which was televised, to ripping up his speech. In those moments, here we were collectively banking on this 80-year-old woman to be the buffer between us and this monster. And she did a hell of a job doing that.
She was amazing. She was an amazing speaker. But again, she's a woman. She'll never get the credit that she deserves. I mean, you know, I do a lot. I used to do a lot of speaking. I think writing my book could tell that, you know, people think I'm too controversial. But talking to women that were involved in construction and giving them the support they need because it's, it's unbelievable. I love talking about this, but I will say that in terms of trades, they say we're in breaking glass ceiling. First of all, the highest percentage of engineers graduating from engineering school was in 2020 or so, and that number was 20%. And it's right around that. It hasn't increased. They say that 10% of the people on construction are women, but, you know, what are they? Most of them are, or not most of them, but they're insurance people, they're secretaries, they're accountants. 6% are really involved in construction. But the most telling thing, I think, is that 4%, and this has not changed in 40 years, 4% of the trades, electricians, plumbers, whatever, are female. And there's this myth that women don't want to do. Well, I'll spend the whole time talking about that. But that is my quest. And what I want to do, and I'm trying to get, you know, some a fund going or something, is go to high schools, especially in underprivileged areas, and teach this girl. You can make big money, baby. And you can, but you know what the best thing about working in construction is? You work on a building and, you know, 20 years later, you're in the car with your kids and you say, I helped build that. And there's very, very few professions where you can say something like that. It's a very rewarding.
And you have the ability to point out some really incredible buildings.
Well, I have my name on a building. That's the best thing in the world.
Which one is that?
It's 667 Madison Avenue. It's Hartz. It's owned by Hartz. And when the owner built it, you know, he put my name, the architect's name, and his, you know, the guy that was working on running the project for Hartz Mountain, our cornerstone. And always
that's cool.
It.
Yeah, well, good for you. That's like having a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, kind of, sort of. The real estate version.
But so, on the other hand, no one will pee on it.
maybe a very big dog, perhaps. So if you watch film footage of people at a Trump rally and they're asked, why do you love Trump? Almost all the time they say, well, he's just like us. He's one of us.
Right.
Yet in your book, you say, quote, he can't stand the working class. The working people who make up his political base, quote, he is well aware of the public relations benefit of being liked by the common man, and he exploited it.
Absolutely.
He hates these people, doesn't he?
He'd go around the job site, glad-handing, almost like, remember, Mayor Koch, how am I doing? But it was just constant. What do you think? How am I doing? How do you like the building? And these people said, oh, he likes this. He loves this, right? Every construction project has what they call a topping out party. When you reach the top, your last piece of steel, your last floor of concrete, whatever, have a big party. And we had the biggest in the world with, you know, releasing balloons, and the mayor and the governor were there. And, you know, we had caviar, whatever the hell. Trump said, I said something, and we, you know, there's a lot of workers. She said, workers? What do you think? They're not coming to the party. They said, what the hell do you think a topping out party is? It celebrates the workers.
All right, it's like on a movie, having a cast and crew party, but not wanting to invite the crew.
Right. Yeah, so he said, we'll have the foreman of the... And I'm sitting there with the construction manager, and they're looking at him watching. I'm saying, no! You know, and people say, oh, you're bragging about... Listen, I was able to control him to slight extent, okay? I said, you must have the workers at that point. It was like 700 people.
Does it drive you crazy when you hear the MAGA crowd say that, that he's one of us, that he...
You know... It doesn't, because he really is one of them when it comes to certain things. Mm. Donald made it possible to be a racist again, you could go out on the street and you could talk about N-word people and you could talk about women and call them C-words and stuff like that, because it's okay. The president does this. Mm. I hate those people. I mean, I don't want to hate anything. Right? Anyone that supports him now, to me, it's just, and you know who supports him? Racist and people like that, stupid people, or, you know, God people, but rich people. I don't care what. No, it's not going to hurt me. If I need an abortion, I'll fly to Italy.
Are you saying rich people have no morals, Barbara?
Saying rich people put their money.
All they care about is money and taxes.
For many of them, yeah. And what does Trump do? Well, Trump lowers their taxes to begin with. They're not paying anything anyway. Trump takes the normal, I don't know what it was, 32% of tax that goes onto corporations and brought it down to 13%. And he got away with it. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing is regulations. Mm-hmm. He lessened the regulations on things like the water supply, on things like chicken that we put on our table. Took away a lot of the power of the agencies that do the regulations. And rich people love that, because that means that their companies will make more money, and so a few people die. And that's just other base.
You're talking about a guy who calls heroic dead soldiers suckers and losers. So the people who die from bad chicken, I don't think keep him up at night, you know?
And, you know, going back to the construction, I mean, you know, why would anyone do this, he used to say. And by the way, he had his ideas about which construction workers and the Italians. I remember the Italians were cool with their hand. Yeah. Mm. So many stereotypes.
Yeah. What kind of boss is he? Is he generous? Does he give praise? Does he just screw you like he screws everybody else? Is he mean, nasty?
Well, you know, of course, he's changed since the last time I worked for him, which is the late 90s. But I have to say, he would give praise to people, and you'll see him doing it in the exact same way, and make him look good. I have the best people. If you are brilliant, wonderful, whatever, and you work for me, that makes me brilliant squared, you know what I'm saying? And that's why he did it. And he always did that. He would pull out someone and say, even people that weren't so, isn't she great? You know, or he's a great.
But then when he fires them and gets rid, or they quit, they become the biggest morons he ever met. They're stupid and incapable. And I would watch this and I'd go, doesn't he understand that that's a reflection on him and his leadership? If they're a moron and stupid and incapable and never did anything, then why did you hire them?
Well, you're right to an extent. The second time I quit, I was working on the West Side projects, and he had to make a deal, made a bad deal, by the way, with the local civic people that were opposing him. And as part of that deal, they had to give running the project to somebody of their choosing, and it was going to be me. Mm-hmm. They picked someone, and then that guy and the head of the Municipal Art Society, which is one of the big opponents, took me to lunch. Well, first I said, I quit. I told Donald I was leaving. And, you know, I didn't make it like, of course, I was upset. But it was just not a brilliant decision, to be honest with you. But my son at the time was having some medical problems. And I mentioned that and said, of course, that's why you're quitting. And that was his reason for me. But meanwhile, these other two people, they took me to lunch and they begged me to stay. They did not want to go see Trump. They want, but I ended up leaving. And where was I going with this? Oh, he didn't want people to think I quit because that would be a reflection on him. It would be someone in a big position that he built up so much he couldn't call me an idiot. And he didn't want that to happen. He didn't want people looking out on him. And that's why when people do walk out on him, he immediately calls them idiots. He means them. And, you know, it gets away with it. Who's going to ask him, you know? Well, Trump, didn't you say 3 months ago this is like the smartest person you ever met? You're a nasty reporter. Get him out of
right,
here.
You right, know? Right, of course. Right. So obviously he's in a lot of trouble. There's obviously evidence of massive criminality, fraud, all of that. Overvaluing, undervaluing. By the way, it's kind of funny when he tries to defend himself by saying, I undervalued things. Well, that's still a crime, right? If you undervalue things on a financial document, it's still a crime. Did you have any sense of any of that in your 18 years with him and his sons and Weisselberg? I mean, I understand that the accounting and the finance and all that corner office stuff isn't exactly the construction wheelhouse that you were in. But, like, was there any sense of that behavior? Because it was so rampant, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the lying. Let me just say one thing about Weisselberg. When I worked on Trump Tower, Weisselberg was in Brooklyn. He was like, you know, he sent out the bills, he collected the money. When he came to Trump Tower, he became an executive vice president. He did the same thing. Mm-hmm. They had, first of all, several in-house people to handle finance and this, that. And then, of course, they had tons of outside accountants. You see them turn up. But what he used to do is he used to say something that was outrageous and then say it enough times that people would believe it. So when it came to like valuing the apartments, he'd just lie and say, you know, I sold so many apartments and I sold them for this much money. And it was all lies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that kind of thing became like, what's this one? Ivana, who I was somewhere close to, was an Olympic skier. It's a dream. She was Olympic groupie. But everyone believed she was Olympic skier because he said it so many times, mm-hmm. and we won't believe him. And, you know, starting out, I believed almost everything he told me. Why wouldn't I?
Well, you're right. He's a pathological liar, and we've seen that. Do you think he's afraid now? Does he feel fear?
You know, I've been thinking about this for like a long time since these lawsuits and indictments have come up. I don't think so. I mean, just a knee check, even though like I said, I've been thinking about it. I don't think so. I think he's angry. I don't think he's afraid.
Do you think he believes this myth about him being Teflon and like he just thinks this is all going to go? I mean, I don't know why he would think that because he now has to come up with almost $600 million between now and like the end of the month. So it would be, unless he is just absolutely certifiably insane and delusional, he has to have some sense that he's in some deep shit. And it might get even deeper. Or does he think somehow this is just all like the Supreme Court, Kavanaugh, they're all going to protect him. Everybody's going to protect him. And it's all going to be fine.
Yes. Hmm. He does not believe that he's above everything. He totally believes that. He doesn't think that he's Teflon. That's a myth and he's going to protect that myth. He believes that. He really thinks nothing is ever going to get to him. And that's why I say, you know, we're making pact with the devil. And it's happening. That's the goddamn about it. Every time you say, you're going to get them now. They don't. I mean, for crying out loud. The first impeachment, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
He said to the guy from Ukraine, that, you know, we'll make a deal with it. And it's there. It's in that. It's on the record. And he gets away with that shit. And then January 6th, I mean, it's just
unreal.
I mean, Mitch McConnell, after the whole thing, says, oh, he's very guilty, and he caused everything, but it's legal, he's not impeachable. Of course, he changed his tune, right?
They all change their tune.
when it comes to me, the funniest thing, most compelling thing is when he tells the Secretary of State about Georgia that he fined him the $12,000 or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. They have him right here.
I think he's going to get convicted on that because they have him. You know, you've seen him all those years in a private enterprise spewing his nonsense in the court of public opinion. For the first time in his life, in a major way, he's being held accountable in the court of law. And the dominoes have already started to fall. And I think they're going to continue to fall. I don't know if that's going to change his behavior. Like, I'm curious to know, like, you know, at the end of this month when he's supposed to pony up the money, is he just going to say, no, I'm not doing it?
He's just going to say no. Yeah.
And then it's going to be up to the court to seize the property.
Yeah, they got to go after him. Yeah.
And then he'll make that a whole big war on Trump thing. And
he'll have a million lawyers dragging it out, so he'll be dead before any of these cases come to court. There's not to worry about that. But, you know, you got to go back to when Trump was working for his father in Trump Village, whatever the name of the place was. Absolutely didn't let any black people rent apartments. Mm-hmm. And whoever went after him, whatever entity, had the proof. They had the proof. They had witnesses. They had people that had been sent in there.
Yeah,
you know,
he settled that case.
Equal resume, so to speak. One was black, one was white. The white got the apartment, black did. They had him cold handed. And they made a deal.
Mm-hmm.
He paid a fine. He agreed to let them look at his books for 2 years, but there was no admission of guilt. They did not take any responsibility. And you know why? I mean, one of the big reasons? Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn taught something when he was very young. He should never, ever, ever admit to anything and apologize. And you show me, he apologized to me once. So that's another story. But and people don't believe the show, it doesn't matter. But he lives that way. He never takes responsibility for anything.
What's the dynamic, in your opinion, with him and Melania and the kids and his dad? Like, is his dad the reason why Trump is so fucked up? Is Donald the reason why his kids are so fucked? Like, is it just like a generational, like, just awful? Awful, narcissistic, brutally abusive parenting? Is that all this is?
Well, and to an extent it is. I mean, I knew his father pretty well. He hated me. And he was so angry at Donald for hiring me and putting me in charge. Mm. It took so long to get over that. But I watched Donald and his father together. And I saw where, you know, the father had to sort of like pull back. And Donald was standing there with kid gloves. And, you know, one time he was so bad to me, and I went in charge and said, you got to get Shredder off my back. You got to just, I can't take it anymore, Don. And he said something to me, not these exact words, but suck it up, baby. I have to take him, and you do too. And then eventually, you know, he was gone. But, yes, look at what the father did to Fred Jr. Look at what he did.
Yeah.
And then and Trump was watching him, and Trump was liking this. And Trump adapted a lot of his things, and Fred really put a lot of pressure on Trump. And together they, you know, they worked out for him. It's a tremendous influence, and Cohen, and tremendous influence. Now, fast forward to Trump and his kids. When I started, Donnie was about 4 years old, I think. And then they had Ivanka, and then after that it was Eric. I read something once that he said, you know, the kids were sitting in his office playing with Legos. I got hysterical. Someone had to calm me down. It was the most preposterous notion. The kids were never in the office. When Ivana brought the kids by for this or that, he was so angry.
Mm.
And, you know, he sent his son off to camp and you know, and so that. He had very little to do with them, as a matter of fact. To my, Ivana had to do it, but of course there were a million nannies. But when Donald divorced Ivana and he didn't do it like he divorced Elizabeth, he did it best sex I ever had on the news. Donnie did not speak to him for a couple of years.
Two questions for you before we go. The first one is Donald Trump a sociopath?
I'm not a psychiatrist, but he looks like
I think
one.
You know him pretty well. I think you've got some mad credentials.
Well, you know, but you have to understand that there was a big evolution there, and I don't know the man who he is today. I can just predict what I know from the past.
My other question is, a year from now, will Melania and Donald still be married? Or
as
together?
As long as she keeps getting her pay. I mean, that's it. She didn't move down to Washington until they renegotiated everything. So
I love that quote. As long as she keeps getting her pay. Barbara, I literally could sit here all day and talk to you. You are definitely going to have to come back and continue this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. It was really fun to talk with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Take care. This episode of The Back Room was edited and produced by me, Andy Ostroy. It was co-edited and co-produced by Maddie Rosenberg and co-produced by Jen Hammoud. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Hollander, and our logo was designed by Cricket Langell. And special thanks to Patricia Wind. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast and also follow or subscribe. Until next time, keep your eyes on Washington, Hollywood, and your own backyards, and have a great week.